The state has ultimate control over the schools.
Yes.
As we talked about earlier, it's just really frustrating, and I would just love to push back on that. You know, it's too rigid. There's zero tolerance. There's bureaucracy. And, you know, it's interesting, being on the school board, one of the things they want us to do is have policies for everything. And there's this long list of things that have policies, that you need policies for. And Croydon looks at this, and it's not just me. I mean, this was true in the school board even before I came on it. Our policy is to not have policies because every case is different. How can I have a general answer for every situation? It's just the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. All right. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is March 11th. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Enjoy your boiled food. That sounds delicious, doesn't it? Boiled food. Anyway, this production right here continues for the third straight year our Liberty Forum discussion series. And I'm really excited to share with you some new voices as well as some old favorites. I want to thank the organizers of Liberty Forum, particularly Marav, who made the event so accessible to School Sucks. And I hope, in exchange for the organizers' hospitality, we are able to once again help promote the Free State Project with our coverage of this important and very enjoyable event. This was actually probably the best Liberty Forum that I ever attended. And again, it was great to meet 10 to 12 people who listen to the show that I'd never interacted with before. Matthew and Mark, those are the names that come to mind because those are the two that I got to talk with the longest. And by longest, unfortunately, it was only like 5 to 15 minutes each. I need to be better at finding time in these events to do those things because that is a great opportunity to get feedback, to get ideas, and to just, you know, kick it. Have you heard that expression? Kicking it with some really cool and smart people. I love that. You know what a better place for that is? The Porcupine Freedom Festival, which happens in June. It goes on for a week. Liberty Forum, on the other hand, is like 2 or 3 days into which I'm trying to pack a substantial amount of activity. Porkfest, 2 or 3 times that length. I could be going on canoe rides with people there. And if you're a newer listener and you want to hear what we've done in the past, go to the series drop-down menu at schoolsucksproject.com and find the Liberty Forum discussion series. This year's interviews are going to come at you pretty fast. There's going to be 5 or 6 over the course of the next week. And I want to say a huge thanks to a listener named Nolan who sent me a new chair from our Amazon wish list. Folks, you don't know how badly I needed a new chair. I never talked about this on the show. The chair I have been sitting in was broken, and I would fall over sometimes. I quietly added the item to the Amazon wish list because I was so embarrassed. Falling over at work, like once a day, it's no good. Productivity hack. Have a chair that you don't fall out of while you're working, and now I do. Thanks to Nolan. He also sent this beautiful pair of Sony headphones that I love. They're like black and red. I can't wait till you see them in an upcoming video. So let me just reiterate something that I mentioned at the beginning of the last show. I'm really appreciative of everybody who supported the show, either through Amazon or through making a monthly contribution, because it made our presence at and coverage of Liberty Forum possible. I got a lot out of the event personally, and I think I might have even created some opportunities for the show in the future. So let's get to it. We lead off with Dr. Jody Underwood, and this is from the Liberty Forum program. Jody Underwood is the founder and owner of the Bardo Project. She lives off the grid with people learning back-to-basic skills. She moved to New Hampshire for the Free State Project in 2007 and is on the Free State Project Board of Directors. She focuses on education both professionally and as chair of her local school board, which recently instituted school choice within the district. Her goal is to revolutionize education. Hey, that sounds like something I would say. The title of the talk that she gave was Rethinking Public Education. It was an open forum, but one of the things that Jody brought to it was a list of 11 problems with the current government schools. So I thought it would be a useful exercise to compare some of the things that we've talked about on this show, including the 3 hidden lessons of school, to Jody's list, especially since she's coming at this from a different vantage point. So thanks for listening, everybody. More stuff is coming soon. And remember, you can learn more about events like these at freestateproject.org. The next one, like I said before, is the Porcupine Freedom Festival, June 21st through the 28th, porkfest.com. All right, here we go.
I'm very pleased to welcome to School Sucks for the first time, Jody Underwood. Hi.
Hi.
Just so people know, you are the owner and founder of the Bardo Project, which is a farm. Where is Bardo?
Bardo is in Croydon, New Hampshire.
And why is that an attraction here in New Hampshire for so many people? I know you have a fest every year, but what goes on at Bardo?
Why is it an attraction? We have a lot of, I guess what I would call interns who come live and stay on the property. So they work for a place to stay.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people have dropped in on Bardo.
Yeah.
We also have a monthly, now it's a monthly potluck. It used to be weekly. Every Sunday we had a potluck, and it used to be well attended all the time. And then we switched it up, and now it's once a month, first Sunday of the month. At around 5 p.m., people like to tour the farm, see the animals. Kids especially like it, and it's turned into a big kid event these days because lots of people are having kids. We're a farm that we raise meat, and pigs is our main thing, but we have other animals as well and eggs. We have rabbits and so meat, birds also. Oh, and various other things during the year. Sorry, it's early in the morning. I can't remember everything.
People
right
should
now.
Know that we are at Liberty Forum. It's the Saturday, 9 a.m.-ish. So we're just getting started. We're just warming up. Yeah, I've only been up there a couple of times, but the reason why I wanted to open with that, I just wanted to let people know. We did a series on agorism recently, and I'm sure there's agorist elements to the Bardo experience. We also did a series, part of that agorism series was permaculture, you know, and sustainable living, people not, you know, just trading with each other, but also being equipped to survive if the grocery store delivery doesn't come one day. And yes. I think that's a really important kind of education, self-sufficiency. So I know that people who have gone to intern with you guys have left there with a lot of that knowledge, which I think is a really great thing to have in New Hampshire.
Right. And what I'm remembering now as you're talking more is we're also off the grid. And that's another part of that sustainable living thing. And so we have held workshops over the years at different times and at Bardo Fest to teach people about how we live, right? What it's like living off the grid, how to set it up, how to do that and raise animals and, you know, and even how to process animals. I mean, we've taught everything at a lot of different levels, and we invite other people to teach things too. It's not just us. So I think that's one of the attractions too.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why I was so interested in pursuing that on my show is it's almost a type of forbidden education. You know, everything from gardening to, you know, gardening for more than just a hobby, and raising animals and processing animals in preparing for difficult situations in the future. It's a good thing to know.
Right, exactly.
So, so I did want to, at the end of last year, start introducing those ideas into my show.
Gotcha.
I actually asked you to be on with me today because you gave a talk yesterday morning called Rethinking Public Education. And you're also, you're on the school board in
I'm
your district?
I'm chair of the school board in Croydon. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, I have been for 3 years.
And before we talk about your presentation yesterday, what inspired you to run and then serve on the school board?
Education has always been my issue, my area. I do education research for a living. I design software for learning, so including games and simulations, and it's really fun stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've also been in classrooms and, you know, big head shake about how things are done. And then, you know, getting on. So why did I join the school board? I wanted to get involved. And since education was my thing, I started going to school board meetings. And then somebody resigned. They had to leave the state. They were moving. And so the then present, current board members asked me, they appointed me to the position. So I didn't even have to go through an election the first time, although I had to run at the end of that person's term, which was just a few months later. And I easily got elected because nobody ran against me. It's a very small town, and they're like looking for people to do it. But so, I mean, that's how I got in. But I'm in my second term. They're 3-year terms, and I'm 1 year into the second term. And so, you know, then the question is, why did I stay? And to be honest, I've thought about quitting many, many times.
Yeah, that was my follow-up is, after that amount of time, are you inspired and excited about the future, or are you frustrated?
Right now, I am excited and inspired, and I have a particular issue that is current, going on right now, that I am excited about. So we started school choice this year. We were in an area agreement, and I don't know if you know what that is, but briefly, we had a 10-year contract with Newport Schools that said, and Newport is the town, the next town over from us,
yeah,
that we would promise to send all our kids there, and they would promise to accept all our kids. And after 10 years, you have to formally stop that contract. Otherwise, it goes on in perpetuity, and the town voted to stop the contract. So we instituted school choice, and it started this year. It was like a 6-year process to go through that.
Right.
And as part of school choice, we have some of our parents opted to send their kids to private school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people have been asking us the whole time, are you sure? Can you send kids to private school paying public money? And we're like, you know, we ran it by the State Department of Ed, and there don't seem to be any laws that can stop us from doing it, and so we're doing it.
Vouchers?
Well, yeah, but we've never called it vouchers, but I guess in essence that's what it is.
Vouchers might be a dirty word at this point.
It might be, so I don't choose to use it.
Yeah.
I don't want any baggage on what we're doing. School choice sounds so much better.
It does, yeah.
But this week we got a letter from the State Department of Education, from the Commissioner Virginia Barry, telling us to cease and desist, to stop paying the private school bills, that we're not allowed to do that. And well, she sent it to the SAU, to our superintendent, and rightfully so. She doesn't want any of her staff to lose their jobs or certifications in what they do, and I don't want her to lose hers either, because I like our superintendent.
Sure, yeah.
She's actually, I mean, I don't know that she would say it in public, but she is school choice, and she wants to support us in what we're doing because she thinks it's a good idea. In this letter, though, Ms. Barry cited a few laws that justified her position, and honestly, some of them didn't justify her position, but she chose those laws anyway, like special ed. You can put special ed kids in private schools if you need to.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? And so public money does go to private schools in that case. So she, like, but she used that to justify her argument to say that you can't. But she left out RSA 194.22, which says towns can make contracts with any other literary institution. I mean, there's a list of things before that. So towns can make contracts with any other literary institution and raise tax money to pay for it.
You know, that's interesting with special ed. I mean, most of my teaching was in a special ed private school that was entirely publicly funded, but you know, not a public school. I don't even know if a private school would be the right word. It was a boarding school. It seemed that, you know, the powers that be in schooling were more than happy to pass off students, you know, with public money to private institutions if those students were difficult to deal with.
Right.
But when it actually comes to giving students choice, you know, suddenly there's all kinds of obstacles.
Exactly.
There.
And we have a poster child in this particular case. We only have 4 kids who have opted to go to private school this year.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
And we're a small town.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, we have something like 60 kids school age, you know.
Yeah.
This girl was not performing well in Newport schools. I mean, just sort of depressed. And she was 5th grade, and she couldn't do anything. She wasn't learning a thing because all she was thinking about was going home, like living through the day and getting home. And her mother opted to put her in the Montessori school in Newport, and she's thriving.
Yeah.
But her parents can't really afford to pay for a private school, even though it's way cheaper than Newport schools.
Yeah.
She's very afraid, her mother, that she would have to put her back in Newport schools, and then she wouldn't be performing at all. She wouldn't be learning anything. So, and she's willing to fight for this, the mother. So,
has there been any public discussion about like this question, what if everybody wanted to go to the Montessori school, who could? Has anyone said anything like that as an objection? Because I'm thinking that, like, most parents, if they're fairly invested in their children's education and they know what Montessori is all about, and they know that, you know, property tax money could be sent there along with their child, has anyone just said, we can't overfill this Montessori school and empty out, the elementary.
Right. I have not heard that argument yet. Mostly we're getting support for this in the town. But there is a contingent that thinks it's the wrong thing. And there's a lot of I told you so's. I knew it wouldn't be legal. You shouldn't have done it. You're risking these kids' education and so on. And we have a town meeting next Saturday. So we'll see how that all pans out. But I have very reasoned arguments as to why we did it, including the law being behind us, as well as precedent all over the state. There are tons of private schools that get public money. I mean, honestly, I think there should be IEPs for all. Don't you?
Individualized education plans.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Like one student, because they struggle particularly, has one, but then 500 who don't are expected to be crammed into the same mold.
Exactly.
Essentially.
That is my point.
Yeah. I think some of that was in the design of the system originally because of the, bureaucratic nature of it. It hasn't evolved much beyond this systematizing and homogenizing effect. And they have, I know I've sat through a lot of meetings in public schools. They're good at the talk, accommodations and modifications and wait till you see. And I didn't see a lot of delivery on, the talking points. They knew the things to say to parents and
taxpayers?
Taxpayers too, but advocates.
Oh,
advocates
okay.
for the students, like I was as a tutor or a college consultant.
I see.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this too, though, is when I started the show 5 years ago, I was much more of an extremist. We were talking as we were walking to the spot about how when people are newer to this, they're more angry,
right.
And I remember dismissing school reform, like right out of the gate. My first episode was going to be about why I'm not interested in politics. So my position on vouchers and school choice was I would have said no, because this is a Trojan horse. The unions are going to come in and they're going to say, in the government too, if public money is going to private institutions, we need to have oversight over the private institutions and scoop them up, under our purview. Teachers need to be unionized. But as time's gone on, and I've invested a lot of time in this conversation about schooling versus education, and I haven't seen a ton of progress out there. There has been some, but obviously the reality is, I think about what I want education to be, which is exactly what you described: individualized education plans, student to student, no collectivization like it is now. And then I think about this current situation, there have to be some incremental steps along the way. And I've opened myself up to, what could they be? What are people doing? How many students would have to leave public school in a district for the district to not be able to justify its funding anymore? Questions like that. So I've backed off that firm position of no, I won't accept any any discussion about any of these things, and everyone should just be unschooled. To say, well, we have this huge system, just talking about unschooling isn't going to get rid of it, especially when you think about the powerful interests involved. So I think this is encouraging, but you're also, coming up head to head against some of those powerful interests, I think.
Yeah, we really are. It's interesting what you said, though, about the government like coming in to swoop up these private schools. And there are some that are called public-private academies.
Yeah.
So Pinkerton is one of those.
Yep.
And so I think there is government oversight over what they do and how they do it. Montessori, the Newport Montessori, they've been approved for attendance only, which means they get to do it in the way they want. But they're still approved and they still have to cover all those subjects that the state wants them to cover.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't be approved. And, the state has this one-size-fits-all model that just doesn't work. I mean, one-size-fits-all just doesn't work.
No.
So I would like to not have them have that level of oversight over private schools. And that sort of segues into what my talk was about yesterday.
Yeah.
Basically, with the audience help, we brainstormed a little bit, looking at 11, and 11 isn't a magic number or anything, but 11 flaws in how public schools operate. The point was, what can we do, right? Short of stealing our neighbors' money to fund the things that we want to do.
Right.
And that's what I mean by can. And then what should we do and how can we go about it and what laws need to be passed or repealed in order for this to happen? And, that's way down the line. But what is that stepwise process? I mean, we didn't come up with an answer or anything. But one of the big ideas that came out of it, I think, was, as far as control goes, is a balance between structure and supporting creativity.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
critical thinking.
Yeah.
So, and again, I don't know what the answer is, but you need some structure. And I think even educational research shows that you need some structure. You know, some people talk about unschooling and let kids do whatever they want. Nah, you know what? Parents put some structure on that too.
Yeah, I've said that. That, you know, if it's fine to let them explore, but parents need to remember that they kind of set the parameters. Like, they control the environment,
right.
you know, and they can put things into the environment that they want. They can remove things that they
exactly.
don't. And yes, you're free within this safe environment until you get a little older, and then maybe it expands
That's
a little
right.
bit, and we start stop home schooling, and we actually get out and do like real world schooling. We
right.
go and see things.
Right. So that was one of the big ideas that came out, and I haven't had enough time to really reflect on it. I want to it was recorded, so I'm going to go home and review that as soon as I get the recording.
Yeah.
And maybe try to, I don't know, write something up about it and put that out there so more people can see these ideas and contribute to them, you know.
So the 11, so this is actually really valuable, though. You've kind of inventoried the current status of schooling. And I'm interested to hear what you came up with and maybe some responses that stuck out to you or some suggestions that stuck out to you in the presentation.
We'll see if I can think about it. I mean, we started by talking about what it means to be educated, because mm-hmm. if you don't know what your goal is, how can we even come up with a common approach to getting there?
Yeah, yes.
And I think most people in the audience were in agreement about what we think it means to be educated. But again, this is from a liberty perspective.
Yeah.
You know, should character be included in that list? And to me, that's a parent's job, is to, you know, make sure their children are grow up in of good character. And, you know, in many cases these days, teachers are like, yeah, but the parents aren't doing it at home, so it's my job. And it's like, yeah, I don't think so. Parents still have the right to raise their kids the way they want to raise them, whether the teacher agrees or not.
I think it's become more challenging to do in today's world. I mean, there's a lot of external stimuli that's competing for attention and maybe in that parental relationship. But one thing that's scaring people a lot is something that they've been calling since the 90s values clarification, which showed up, and it's definitely part of Common Core, where they're actually testing for attitudes, you know, attitudes and values in public school. And, you know, this has been part of the curriculum since at least No Child Left Behind. Some people would say this goes all the way back, you know, to at least the founding of the Department of Education, a more national curriculum, right? And that homogenizing effect that we talked about before, that was the intentions of the progressives 100 years ago. Right. So that scares people. And to say that that is not a part of what any government school system should be doing, that's perfectly understandable. There's, you know, Peg Luksic is?
I know.
She gave a talk. This was about whatever the federal plan was before No Child Left Behind in the 1990s. And it was called Who Controls Our Children? And she talked about this values clarification and this outcomes-based education, they called it, which sounds, they always come up with things that sound nice. And right. she said,
we need to learn how to do that.
People would respond to her because she was clearly conservative. She had a conservative attitude about education, and people would say, you just don't want Bill Clinton's Secretary of Education control, you know, telling your children. And she said, I don't care who it is. Think about, you know, if you give this power to somebody, sooner or later, somebody who you don't like, who scares you,
exactly.
is going to have it. So let's stop doing this now. So that was my expansion of your first one. The school should not be in charge of that kind of education, that character education. I totally agree.
Good. We're in agreement. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we talked about like good ways to learn, our best experiences in learning, just to get people, you know, warmed up into mm-hmm. thinking about school and how it should be. And then, you know, I outlined the excuses you hear all the time about what's wrong with school is class size and money, right? Our schools aren't getting enough money. They're getting too much money.
Right.
And you're both, right? Teachers aren't getting paid enough, blah, blah, blah. And these are not even Band-Aids because they haven't affected anything, right? You've seen those graphs that the more money you spend, flatline in scores, if scores
yeah.
are the way to measure it.
By their own metrics, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the scores, of course, that's a whole nother conversation about
right,
whether
right.
that's the right way to measure it. But yeah, those aren't really helping. So the flaws. And, you know, it started with geographic location. Schools sort of came into existence because people were spread far and wide, and you wanted to bring them to one place for shared resources and to have that certified teacher, somebody who knows how to teach. So even that idea of the authority of a teacher is one of those flaws that comes in, right? And that's sort of a 12th. I didn't put that separate, but that comes into the geographic location thing.
Agree, yeah.
Age determines who you're grouped with.
Yeah, that's...
kind of a whole episode on that, right?
Yeah, that's courtesy of the Germans, yeah. That was that actually had, I think, some kind of military application originally.
Was that right?
They wanted to bond people that way, by age, and understand superiority by seniority, essentially, right? So there would be a hierarchy based on experience.
Right.
That was Kaiser Wilhelm. That's who but that's irrelevant.
Right. No, that's okay. You know, so we talked about skills-based, interest-based groups. Like those would be better ways
absolutely
to do it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know about this thing called project-based learning?
I do. Yeah. I really, from what I know so far, I support project-based learning.
Me too.
And, you know, the other thing I found, like, I worked in a lot of mixed-age classrooms when I worked at that boarding school. And even kids who didn't get along, when there was some kind of project setting, some kind of educational setting, you would see the older, more capable kids, like, want to bring younger, more challenged kids up to speed so the project could keep moving along as a group. It was a nice thing to see.
Yeah, sort of like the old one-room schoolhouse.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
So you could actually get, I mean, I had teacher's aides, but I could actually get, recruit more teacher's aides as, you know, the students would want to help younger students. Yeah,
right.
It was helpful.
So, yeah, that was one of them. Public schools are paid for by taxation.
Oh, yeah. That's problem number one.
That's a nice flaw. Yeah. So that's number three for me. And of course, this is where I brought up Croydon's problem that we want it to pay for private schools, too. And, you know, again, so is taxation even necessary? So do you know this book, A Beautiful Tree?
No.
It's you will enjoy it. So somebody wanted to see if in the poorest countries in the world, how they were educating their kids. And not even just the poorest countries, but in the poorest towns in the poorest countries. And they went to Africa, India, and China and looked around. And parents who either didn't like the government schools, and they called them government schools in this book, and maybe in those countries that's exactly what they are called. In this country, we have the misnomer of calling them public schools, which is one of my flaws that I'll talk about later. But they found that parents were basically pooling money to have small schools. Their kids were doing as well as anybody in the government schools, if not better.
Yeah.
And the poorest of the poor were given scholarships in those schools. They just did it. In some cases, they lived far enough away that they couldn't get their kids to government schools.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's what they did. In China, it was like that. But in India and Africa, these small homegrown schools just developed, and you don't need tax money to do that. And it's not expensive. I think they found that it was like a maximum of 10% of the family's salary paid for the schooling. It was something to that effect, but it was at a low level. It might even have been less than that. But A Beautiful Tree.
I will look that up. Yeah, and that was, I think, like the first or second episode of my show, talking about the importance of understanding that problem, that when you're not, you don't have a choice to pay for something, don't expect quality all the time.
And then what happened when the parents were involved, the schools responded to them. And so they had more say in what happened in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once you start paying for something, you want the quality to come out of it. And with public schools where you think it's free, you don't even think you have the right to tell schools how you want them to operate.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good point. And you are also kind of made to feel like you're lucky to have it. Hey, this is a service
that
you're getting.
Exactly.
Not realizing that there's just, you know, a longer tube that takes your money to the school.
Right.
For most people.
Exactly. And so then, you know, we threw around the ideas of maybe it could be needs-based, maybe for those families that really can't afford it, there's other ways to get there, or insurance. If something happens, then an insurance company would pay your tuition if you need it.
Right? Sure,
there's other possibilities that we can think about for how to fund schools that everybody can go to. Right, and this goes beyond homeschooling, right, and unschooling, if that's like the ideal that we want. But because you always end up in groups anyway. It's not an individual and lock your kid in the closet and have them learn. Right,
yeah, absolutely.
So moving on, the government must produce schools. So even if, and I don't know if we're going to agree on this, even if the government should provide the opportunity for schools, it doesn't mean they should produce it. And we have tons of examples like that. If you can't afford food, the government gives you food stamps. They don't manufacture the food that you need.
Right. Yeah.
So why shouldn't school run with the same way? Right.
That's actually a good point. And that's where, is that where you would say the school choice plans come in?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
It supports it immeasurably. And I also love, and this is in this slide that I have, that the entire New Hampshire public schooling is based on a phrase in the Constitution that says this. The legislature should cherish the interest of literature and the sciences and all seminaries and public schools. And in the same paragraph, it says it can't use taxes to fund religious schools. So therefore, cherish can't possibly mean fund. Right?
Wow. Yeah, so they really stretched that.
They stretched it.
Yeah.
And then in the same paragraph, later on, it says that monopolies are bad.
Uh-oh.
And the irony is just so rich because the government has this huge monopoly on public schools.
Absolutely, yeah.
Flaw number five is compulsory education. Should we force kids to be in school?
Well, only if you want to make sure that most of them don't enjoy it. You know?
Exactly. Right. And has it been your experience, Brett, that when you give people freedom for learning or whatever, they shine? They make choices and they want to do them. They embrace them.
This was actually one of the most significant wake-ups of my career. When I was trying to, you know, working my way through private school or this boarding school, which I had a variety of different jobs over a course of 4 years, 6 years really, in two private schools. And then I started doing SAT tutoring, and these were kids who wanted to have somebody else come in and work with them so they could improve their test scores because they were invested in the idea of going to college. Their engagement versus what I had been doing all those years previous, and even the difference between two kids I was tutoring, one who wanted to be there, the other one whose parents kind of helicoptered around and said, you know, 1800, 1900 on the SAT is not good enough, so you're going into this class. You could really see the difference. And the engagement, their enthusiasm, the progress that they made with me all depended on how much they wanted to be there or not. So, yeah, I think the compulsory thing is a huge problem.
And you have to wonder with those kids whose parents were forcing them to do things, if they had just, like, let the reins go a little bit, how much more the kids would want to be there.
Yeah.
And I've just seen it happen with little kids even, the ones who are, you know, the 2 to 4 year olds who are so, no, I don't want to do it. And you give them a little freedom and then they're going to choose to do things. I can't say it's hands down, and you need to have some structure again, you know, getting back to that. But
yeah, but using that curiosity and that enthusiasm for new things as a motivator for education is so valuable. I remember I had, like, young nieces and nephews at the time that I was working with high school students, and comparing those two experiences of the why are we doing this? Can I do this? Can I do that? With these high school kids that didn't really seem interested in too much. You know, and I said, oh, this is like both ends of the process, before
That's right.
and after.
Before it's yeah. beaten out of them. Yeah. You know, so flaw number six is the idea that academics will get you ahead in life.
Yeah, that used to be a thing, I guess. So
that's right.
A long time ago.
But I don't think it's even a long time ago. I mean, they're still pushing it now. Everybody should go to college, right?
Oh, they're pushing it more than ever, which has made college more worthless
than
ever.
That's right.
I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe it was 15 years before they were telling me that it actually meant something. It was actually true. When I graduated from college in the year 2000, everybody else in those interviews had college degrees. And, you know, now it's even more. And, you know, people go, they think college is just like the 13th grade, so they go for liberal arts. I went for communications. That was, you know, a mistake. Or to business management, like degrees that don't mean
anything. Soft degrees, yeah.
Yeah, soft degrees, yeah. Where you're coming out with no, you're, if you're spending $100,000 and you're not leaving with any, like, fine skills, that was a waste of money. But people are doing it because they're told that at the other end of this 4 more years of schooling, opportunity awaits.
So interesting. I have a friend, he and his now ex-wife, they're both on the liberal end of things, the progressive end of, mm-hmm. of politics. And but John, my friend, he pulled his daughter out of school because they weren't letting her read to her potential.
Yeah.
Because he started homeschooling her. And then his son, who was brilliant from an early age, he started his own business when he was in high school doing programming. And he decided that he didn't want to go to college, and his parents supported that decision. He's like, why bother? I'm going to get into debt, and I mean, I can make more money now and have more experience than if I go to school for 4 years to learn stuff I already know and just waste my time and spend a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And they completely supported him. I was just thrilled with that they were open to that idea.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I think that is great. And I've had people on the show, like young kids who've started businesses like that, and have really rethought the whole college thing. It is just putting yourself, if you're just going and it's in the way of something you already know, that makes no sense at all. I mean, if somebody wants to be a doctor or a lawyer, yeah, I guess, you know, don't drop out of high school and try to be a free market
doctor. Yes,
yeah,
right.
No way
that would be hard.
There's no way to do that yet.
Right. Yet.
But yeah, there's definitely too many people going to college, I think.
Right. You know, and the other thing is that people think that academically smart means smart. Like, that's the only definition.
Oh,
and it's just so wrong.
Yeah.
And we have to turn that around, too.
Yeah.
And then I question, should all schools teach academic subjects? Right? So we talked before about having state approval of schools.
Yeah.
And they have to cover math and social studies and cover New Hampshire history. And, I mean, you know, the list that you can imagine, including health and, you know, just all these other things. And one of my flaws later gets into this, but maybe we should have really focused schools. Maybe there's one school that you send your kids to learn to read and write.
Yeah, yeah.
For example, right? And other than that, let's have cross-subject things going on. Why do you have a subject? Shouldn't it be critical thinking for X? I don't even know what that would be, but...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's some values too, like if you really want to learn some, but also what subjects are. Like,
yes.
Why is there a subject called American history?
Right.
And why does it last all year? Now, we know the answers to these questions. It's because it's the most efficient.
Right.
You know, it's the most efficient thing they could come up with to service hundreds or thousands of kids at the same time in a school or in a district. But why wouldn't the Mexican War be... That is a subject. You know, what's the subject of your paper? But if somebody wanted to do a class on a very specific thing, and this is becoming with things like Udemy, I don't know if you've seen some of these online.
I've seen it referred to. I haven't looked at it yet.
Where you're really, really specifying. And it's also like, I just want to learn about this. My motivation goes here. My enthusiasm goes here. This, my best foot forward is onto this instead of all this other stuff. I mean, I remember sitting through history classes and being like, yeah, that's kind of interesting. And then I'll go back to sleep, you know, for
right.
a week.
Right.
So being able to really hone in on, first of all, what students are interested in, but also for students to have more choice in what they're interested in would
right.
make a huge difference. So there's all kinds of opportunities with that, with what you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm gonna go back up to the geography thing for a second, because you reminded me of something. Geography isn't an issue partly because of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things we can do there. You can learn from anywhere these days, and yet you have to go to your district school in so many places. Like, they're not keeping up, you know?
Right, exactly.
So interesting. Okay, so number 7 is schools must prepare kids for the 21st century. You know, because we think so differently now than we did in the 20th century. What? But that's one of their, you know, marketing points, you know, that you have to rely on them more because they know what the future is going to be like. Wait, they have a crystal ball?
Never found that to be the case.
Right, exactly. And, you know, interestingly too, in education research, there's people are looking at how to teach critical thinking and systems thinking.
Yeah.
And it's some of it's good research. But what I am afraid of is as soon as they figure something out that's good for the small population that they test their theories on, it's going to become the standard and the rigor, and you have to do it this way. And this is how you teach critical thinking. And this is the right answer in your critical thinking class. Like, I'm afraid that that's where it'll go.
You know, one of the most interesting investigations that I wound up doing was somebody sent me something a couple years ago about these conservatives in Texas who were fighting a critical thinking curriculum in their schools. And what it turned out was they were using the term critical thinking as the new buzzword, as the new outcomes-based education, accommodations and modifications, whatever. It was a euphemism for a kind of conditioning, a kind of behaviorism, it actually turned out. So somebody sent it to me like, hey, aren't conservatives in Texas dumb? Look at this. And what it turned into is that what they were fighting against was actually quite scary. And it was not critical thinking. So it also opens a door into, like, this is critical thinking. Like, we have to teach critical thinking, so this is critical thinking.
Right.
And you could also do critical thinking in kind of a... there's a book that we were talking about. It came into my mind when we've been talking about it on the show. It came into my mind when you said there's this misconception that more school means better thinkers, called Disciplined Minds, mostly focusing on scientists, and how more schooling actually just forces them into a smaller box ideologically. So when people could have something called critical thinking in public schools, but they could also have it happen in like a playpen, where it's like, yes, these are the conclusions about climate change. I'll give you those. These are the conclusions about political science and why, you know, progressivism and the left is better. We'll give you those. But now we're going to just help you think critically to the path to get to the conclusions
exactly.
that we give you. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Common Core is pushing that,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Right.
And then to just, it's sort of an aside, but there was an email sent by Virginia Barry, Commissioner of Education in New Hampshire,
yeah.
that said, hey, I found this article that supports Common Core. We need to find more articles like this to support it, to get people on our side. And I'm thinking, so you're really not modeling critical thinking here, are you? Because what you should be doing is finding articles on all sides of the story and make a decision based on those criteria that you're looking at, you know, in the cases that you see. No, she's just looking to support Common Core.
Right.
There is no question. It is the right thing, right? Right.
Yeah.
All right, number 8, subjects should be isolated from one another. And we talked about that a little bit.
Absolutely.
Already. You know, they teach you how to do things. You should solve for X in algebra and not Y, not really. Like, what is that all about? What is the thinking that you're supposed to be learning in algebra?
Oh,
right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. This is, I always say this on my show that, you know, when I tutored SAT math, kids had learned these mathematical formulas, not as like something that somebody had figured out as an application to a problem, but as they learned them more like magic spells.
That's right.
You know, like, why is the distance formula the distance formula? Or something like, what is pi is another one I always use. Why is this, what is this magic number? What does it do? And if you don't have context for what you're learning, it's also hard to retain it. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I learned a bunch of magic spells that solved all this stuff in ninth grade, but I don't remember them because I don't know what they did or why they did what they did.
Absolutely. And even, you know, I remember kids talking about like just simple arithmetic problems and they don't know whether to multiply, divide, add or subtract, because
yeah,
those
yeah.
are also magic incantations.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's one of those. Which one? Subtract? Like, they're guessing. They don't even know how to think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're up to number 9 now. Standardized tests help students perform well.
I don't get that.
Me neither, but it's one of those flaws.
Well, okay. If you use incredibly vague words like perform well, like they do, perform well according to who, what is well. Yeah, I guess that could be a true statement. Like if the performance is determined by the school and teachers perform well by teaching to the test, but not, you know, getting diverted into
sure.
conversations.
That's right.
Or so, yeah, I mean, I guess there is truth in that statement as long as you have the most convenient definitions for the school system in perform well.
That's right. Yeah, let's change the meanings of words kind of thing, right?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
speak vaguely enough so you can come up with anything. And, you know, I will grant it that when standardized tests first came out, the SAT, it was as a gatekeeper to college because they were just getting flooded with applications and it was just a first round. It wasn't the final thing, but it was one way to help them figure out who should attend their colleges. I don't really have a problem with that. But to use it, I mean, so even now with like the Common Core test.
It's a national standardized test for Common Core.
Yeah. And in New Hampshire, they're saying you can either take, you have to take a test at the end of the year and you could smarter balance.
Okay.
The smarter balanced assessment. They're claiming that they're going to give formative feedback to teachers based on these scores and that'll help kids learn. It's not true though. They're taking the test at the end of the year. They're not going to get the scores till the summer. The teachers aren't even going to have those kids anymore.
Exactly.
It's just,
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that future teachers could use them. And I do understand the college argument that sometimes maybe just for the efficiency of that process, yeah, it would make sense to be able to attach numbers to applications. And I always said this to kids when I was consulting for college. I said, look, if you don't test well, go to a smaller school where you're more, in the initial pass-through, you're more than just a number. If you're applying to, you know, Arizona State University and you're one of 50,000, you're two numbers. Your life is summed up by two numbers or three numbers on the SAT or the ACT. It really hurt teachers, too. I mean, I just remember being in graduate school, and I was very naive. I wanted to I was getting certified to teach secondary history and also getting a master's in educational administration at the same time. And I had never taught in a public school. All the people in class with me in this graduate program were already public school teachers in Massachusetts and New York. And I say, you know what those two states imply as far as regulation and bureaucracy. They were able to crush my enthusiasm in like a year, just with their stories about how they couldn't do anything. And this was supposed to be like the most enthusiastic time of their career. And it had already been crushed for almost everybody in that room in less than 5 years. They were all getting their master's because they needed to, it was a requirement to keep teaching in those states beyond 5 years. So they were all within their first 5 years of teaching. Their enthusiasm had been destroyed. So it's not just students who aren't performing well because of these tests. Like, they weren't even passionate about what they were doing anymore. Yeah. And maybe some people just get into teaching because, like, yeah, whatever, I'll teach. But a lot of people that I remember working with initially were really excited about it. And I was really excited about it. But that went out the window pretty quickly.
Yeah, you get a lot of people who start out excited. Very true. Those who lose it, many leave, right? Mm-hmm. But I remember my cousin's daughter, when she was in college and trying to figure out what to major in, and she was like, well, I'm not really good at anything, so maybe I'll just go into teaching.
Yeah. Yeah.
How sad is that? And, you know, you're in a union, you got a solid job, you have summers off, you get a pension. Like, why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah, they told my mom, I mean, my mom is 64. They told her that she could teach or be a secretary or a nurse.
That's it.
Yeah.
Back then, that's right. Well, and that was true for my mother, who's 85.
Yeah.
Also,
yep,
and
yep.
My mother was a public school teacher in New York City.
Mm.
So that she has all those benefits. All right, number 10. Public schools are for children. So if they're really public, shouldn't anybody be allowed to take a class? If I'm ready to learn biology or chemistry or something, I pay for it. I pay my tax dollars, right? Shouldn't I be able to go into a high school and take a class there?
That would be an interesting test.
Wouldn't it?
No, of course.
No, they won't let you.
Yeah, it would. I think they could claim student safety. You know, if weird adults start wanting to.
So give me a background check. Okay. Yeah. Really? That they even have that. I mean, for a parent to even go on a bus with kids, they have to fingerprint them and run a background check.
Yep.
It's like,
Have you ever seen the movie Billy Madison?
No.
It's an Adam Sandler movie, mm-hmm. And he wants to inherit his father's company. The boy, you know, he's the product of just this privileged life. His father finds out that not only has he not done anything with his adult life, he's cheated his way through school. So he knows nothing, you know, according to school equals education. You didn't do well in school, so you know nothing. And he really did know nothing. He just sat around a pool drinking all day. His father makes him go all the way back from first grade through 12th grade, doing every grade in 2 weeks. And, you know, it doesn't seem very realistic because I remember, like, I saw the movie when I was student teaching in Western Massachusetts, and I said, they would not let a man like this be around 6 and 7 year olds.
Right.
But it's an interesting question. If somebody really was like, you know, I really need biology and I'm paying for the schools and, you know, I have this opportunity at work, like, can I just take a biology class? Yeah, you're right. You can't do that. That's interesting.
Yep. And then my last flaw is that the state has ultimate control over the schools.
Yes.
Yes. And as we talked about earlier, it's just really frustrating, and I would just love to push back on that. You know, it's too rigid. There's zero tolerance. There's bureaucracy. And, you know, it's interesting, being on the school board, one of the things they want us to do is have policies for everything, and there's this long list of things that have policies that you need policies for. And Croydon looks at this, and it's not just me. I mean, this was true in the school board even before I came on it. Our policy is to not have policies.
Yes.
because every case is different. How can I have a general answer for every situation? It's just the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
So I would love to take a closer look at the presentation and maybe even include it in the show notes, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure.
Asked you for a half hour of your time this morning. Thank you for an hour. Three quarters of an hour.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. So I really appreciate your time. I learned a lot. I haven't paid much attention to, you know, educational politics in New Hampshire. And it's something that I've decided that maybe I should take a closer look at. Maybe that would help.
Maybe you're ready again.
Yeah, and enhance my show a little bit. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. This was fun.